thought I would start by just showing you a provocative picture to get you in the mood for the kinds of issues that I want to discuss. Before I reveal what it is, I thought I'd ask for ideas about what the picture is. Somebody said it's the sun, but no.
Ball box.
Okay. Yes, it is ball box. This is a canonical example of a multicellular or colonial organism, ball box. It's several hundred microns across, and it's composed of thousands of somatic cells that are on the surface and allow the organism to swim through its fluid environment with flagella. Now, I'll have a lot more to say about this later on in my talk, but for the moment, I want you to realize that this is a time exposure of a ball box sitting in its normal fluid medium with a whole bunch of microspheres around to allow us to trace the flow that's created by all of these flagella. And you can see that it is a very complicated flow field. And the purpose of my talk today is to suggest to you that the issues surrounding evolutionary transitions to multicellularity are intimately, possibly, connected with the whole issue of the fluid environment in which multicellular organisms live and the stirring that's created by those that are motile through the action of flagella. Now, when we talk about multicellularity, I'm going to suggest for the purpose of today's talk that we might consider two general classes of multicellularity, namely systems in which we have individual organisms that retain their identity yet collectively act in ways that enhance their viability and are synergistic, and truly multicellular or colonial organisms like ball box. So my talk is going to be divided into two parts. The first, I'm going to introduce you to an interesting state of matter, a highly concentrated bacterial situation, which we call the zooming biomimetic, ZBM for short. And I show it here in a real-time movie. This is a collection of Bacillus subtilis on the scale of several hundred microns, a volume fraction that's order one, maybe 0.3 or 0.4. And you can see it's a kind of turbulent state in which there are large-scale coherent vortices and eddies. And I'll suggest to you that this is an interesting model system to understand not only some interesting biological issues, but also physics and mathematical issues about the emergence of coherent structures in systems of self-propelled organisms. And there's certainly a lot of applied mathematics work on swarming and on collective behavior in systems of self-propelled particles. And these experiments and related theory suggest directions to go in to understand further these interesting dynamics. And I will spend a fair amount of time talking about some of the theoretical challenges in understanding the mechanism of formation of this state and also the stirring that comes from it. So the basic theme is the interplay between the motility of microorganisms, their ability to move around, the mixing that comes from the action of those, let's say flagella in this case, and the implications for multicellularity. So the second example I'll focus on is ball box, or the larger class of photosynthetic green algae known as the volvocene green algae, which you see here. And I'll talk about some issues involving the competition between diffusion as a means of nutrient uptake or waste disposal and mixing coming from those flagella. And I'll suggest to you actually that the issue of the scaling law for nutrient uptake as a function of size is very important in the evolutionary transition to multicellularity. And it has a very interesting role to be played by the fluid stirring created by those flagella. And I'll tell you about some mathematical models and some experiments that test those models. So let me start with something that you're probably all familiar with, and please excuse me if I'm telling you something you know very well, but I just want to set the stage in this kind of audience that we're all on the same wavelength. Let's talk about the swimming of bacteria through their fluid environment. Bacillus subtilis, E. coli, common paratrichously flagellated bacteria. That means that they have multiple flagella coming off of their cell body all around. So if we look back at the classic work in which it was first understood that the swimming proceeds, as you see over there to the right, we first of all have organisms that are several microns long, but whose flagella can be 10 or 15 microns long behind. These are helical objects that are long and skinny. They're 20 nanometers across. They can be 15 or 20 microns long. And the classic run and tumble swimming of these organisms, which you see here, courtesy of Howard Berg's group at Harvard, which has developed fluorescent techniques to visualize these things in real time, consists of, indeed, two modes of motion. When the multiple rotary motors, which turn these helical flagella, are all rotating in the same direction, there forms behind the cell a coherent bundle, a kind of superhelix of all of those flagella, which allows the organism to move through its fluid environment in pretty much a straight line at speeds of 10 or 20 microns per second. And through a stochastic process, with a time constant on the order of a second or so, one or more of these motors reverse and this flagellar bundle falls apart to a greater or lesser extent, as you see the tumbles that occasionally happen here. This leads to a bad hair day in which some of the flagella are rotating counterclockwise, some of them are rotating clockwise, the cell body tumbles and reorients, and then a resynchronization occurs and it moves off in a new direction. Now, when you look at this process, there are questions on many different length scales that you can ask. You can worry about the systems biology, let's say, of the internal regulatory networks that are responsible for this run and tumble behavior, for the switching of the motor. You can worry about the elastic properties of these flagella. And in fact, there's a fascinating process, since there's some discussion about materials here, in which the action of the motor reversal actually flips the handedness of the flagellum, so that what was, let's say, a left-handed helix being rotated one way flips dynamically to a right-handed helix going the opposite way through a kink that propagates from the cell body outwards. And this kind of bistability to an elastic object is not something that you see in ordinary human-scale phenomena, but it happens here in spades. And in fact, there are beautiful experiments from 20 years ago by Otani showing that the simple act of flowing fluid past a detached flagellum will initiate periodic chirality inversions which travel down the length of the flagellum. So you force the system uniformly and you get these chirality oscillations. And so there's a lot of interesting material science, basically, a long story about the origins of this bistability, from the packing of the monomers of flagellum that make up the polymers, all through to the fluid mechanics of how this triggering occurs. But what I want to focus on is the fluid stirring. So let me just point out that the typical swimming speeds of these organisms are small, maybe 10 or 20 microns per second, and the typical approach to thinking about, say, chemotaxis and other phenomena is to think about the individual bacterium and its response to its environment. But you can appreciate it, I hope, that by putting together large numbers of these organisms, that it's inevitable that the fluid stirring that's created by those flagella will start to become more and more important. So let me just segue a little into some mathematics about the relevant fluid mechanics operating in these systems. So all of you certainly have heard of the Reynolds number. How many have heard of the Reynolds number? How many have heard of the Peclet number?
Wow.
Oh, my job is done. Well, let me remind you, just so that we get all the get everything down. So if we're talking about a standard Newtonian fluid with an ordinary viscosity, then of course we're basically looking at the Navier-Stokes equations. And if we ask about the relative importance of the advective and time-dependent terms on the left-hand side of Navier-Stokes to, let's say, the viscous dissipation, then we just do dimensional analysis. We say the typical advective term, if we have a characteristic velocity capital U, a characteristic length scale L, so gradients look like U over L, will have a ratio of inertia to viscous dissipation that looks like UL over nu, where nu, eta over rho, is the kinematic viscosity. And that has units of a diffusion constant. And so for the typical swimming speed of a bacterium, the typical length scale, 10 microns, and the typical fluid kinematic viscosity, the Reynolds number for a single bacterium might be 10 to the minus 4. Right, so there's no inertia. It stops swimming. It stops moving. That's end of story. Likewise, if we have anything in a fluid that is a passive scalar, that is oxygen concentration, concentration of any chemical, C, that evolves in time and is advected around and diffuses with diffusion constant B, we can also ask about the relative importance of advection to diffusion. So we just do the same dimensional analysis, and you end up with something that looks like UL over D, where D is the diffusion constant. And because D is three orders of magnitude smaller than nu for water, even for small molecules, this Peclet number is naturally much larger. At the scale of a single bacterium, it's still of order 0.1 or so. So the standard lore that stirring doesn't matter for an individual bacterium, something that was emphasized very significantly by the classic work of Berg and Purcell, is true. But the rest of my talk is going to be basically a discussion of what happens in multicellular configurations, whether it's individuals or truly multicellular organisms, when this breaks down, when the Peclet number is large. And we will see, actually, as I get to the end, that the volvocene green algae supply us with a ready-made collection of species with which to investigate the scaling laws of metabolic processes, et cetera, as a function of Peclet number. Yes?
So I realize I'm going to explain what it is in the physical.
Sure. So when I ask myself about how is the concentration of some chemical in the fluid transported around, I can think of three ways. I can say, well, there's some explicit time dependence here. Maybe something was just released from a cell and it's rising. But if there's fluid flow in the system, then if, let's say, there's a concentration gradient and there's a flow this way, then that fluid can carry that higher concentration to me as I stand at this point in space. And that's represented by the U dot grad C term. So the concentration changes here because the fluid velocity brought in that concentration from somewhere else. And then there's the usual diffusion term, which is in the absence of any fluid flow, if there's a gradient Fick's law, give me a flux. So this is the relative importance of that fluid advection to diffusion. Does that make sense?
Okay.
So
momentum transport versus random transport.
Yes. Okay. So to set the stage for the first part of this, where we're talking about individual organisms collectively acting together, but retaining their individuality, let me remind you about a very classic phenomenon in bacterial suspension known as bioconvection. Here you see a movie of it. I'll explain this in detail and replay the movie. So let's consider an organism like Bacillus subtilis, which is an obligate aerobe that needs oxygen to live. If you place a concentration of, say, 10 to the 7th or so bacteria per cubic centimeter in a drop of fluid, here you see a drop of fluid about a centimeter across, those bacteria will consume the dissolved oxygen in a matter of a few minutes. And after that, they will search around for more oxygen. If the drop is, say, sitting on the top of a petri dish, the more oxygen is at the air-water interface above. So they will swim up to the surface to find the greater oxygen concentration, the standard chemotaxis, here oxygen taxis. But unfortunately for these poor bacteria, they are slightly denser than the fluid they're swimming in. So it's a little bit like Sisyphus of Greek mythology. They swim up to the surface only to have created an unstable situation, because that thin accumulated layer of bacteria is now a denser fluid on top of a lighter fluid. And as you know, that's unstable. And so this produces plumes of downwelling bacteria, but the oxygen gradient still points up. So in steady state, this leads actually to a convective pattern that's very much analogous to what's called thermal convection, or Rayleigh-Bennard convection, where you heat a fluid from below and you get these circulating rolls. Now, in the standard geometry that one would do in the lab, a petri dish with a flat meniscus, you get these beautiful steady state rolls and can study their instabilities and all that. In this geometry, what you saw in this time-lapse movie over the course of several hours was, well, there's cell growth going on here, so there's some nonsense that goes on. But at some point, there's a threshold crossed, and you start seeing these bioconvective plumes, actually in a radial pattern coming off of the contact line of this sessile drop, and eventually plumes that form and actually slide to the edge of the drop. So we're just looking down at this petri dish in dark field illumination. And it's these funny plumes that
so
actually...
light is higher density?
Light is higher concentration, of bacteria. And so these plumes, which bring all the bacteria to the edge of this line, are responsible for an interesting self-concentration phenomenon, which I want to talk about next. But in order to understand that, let's talk a little bit about what's the appropriate mathematical representation for these kinds of phenomena. What are the degrees of freedom? How do we think about this from a PDE perspective?
And it's denser at the contact line because the contact line is pinned, or?
The contact line is pinned here, and I'll show you a side view where you'll actually see the nature of the flows. There's a trapping phenomenon at the corner. So, look, the players in this problem are three. There is the oxygen concentration, I'll call it C, and it evolves in time. It's advected, it diffuses with a diffusion constant of something like 10 to the minus 5 centimeters squared per second, so that's the standard scale of interest. And then the bacteria, whose concentration is N, will consume the oxygen at a rate proportional to their number. And that consumption rate may itself depend on the concentration, because if the concentration falls too low, their metabolism shuts down and they stop consuming. The number density of bacteria evolves by a standard kind of chemotaxis equation. There's an advection term from the fluid flow, which is not standard. There's diffusion, because that random walking of the bacteria in their run and tumble behavior is responsible on the large scale for diffusion. And it's an interesting coincidence of nature, I think, that the effective diffusion constant, mean step size squared divided by tumble time, is about the same as that for oxygen. So the bacteria have tuned their effective diffusivity to be comparable to that they're looking for. And then there's a chemotaxis term. So since this is a conservation law, this would be the divergence of a flux. And the flux will be the number density times a characteristic velocity. And in this case, the simplest model is that the velocity is proportional, R being the proportionality constant, to the gradient of the oxygen concentration. So they swim up the concentration gradient. Yes?
I can follow up on the use of the adjective. Interesting. Is the diffusion constant of these guys closer to the diffusion constant of oxygen than the diffusion constant of other bacteria?
Well, I don't think so. I think they're all... The typical size of bacteria runs size time scale between tumbling events is pretty much the same. So, but oxygen or any other small molecule is the same diffusion. Okay, so this is a fundamentally nonlinear contribution. Nonlinear in the sense of bilinear in concentration and number density. And that will come back to be an interesting feature in these systems, as people like Meredith knows. They're very interesting kinds of singularities that can be formed in systems governed by this so-called Keller-Siegel nonlinearity. And then there's the fluid mechanics in the system. We have the usual F equals ma per unit volume of a fluid, and then there's a gravitational forcing in the problem because the bacteria are denser than the fluid, so there's a little extra buoyancy coming from their density. So when they have consumed the oxygen concentration C as a function of height in the drop will have developed some kind of profile like this, and they simply chemotactically climb up that concentration gradient. But this response coefficient, just like this consumption coefficient, also disappears when the system is too deprived of oxygen. Their chemotaxis shuts off. So in fact, when the oxygen concentration is too low, they don't chemotax at all. And so as they move toward the top of the drop, they'll actually leave an interesting depletion zone, which we can see. And I bring this up because I want you to understand the whole dynamics of this, because we'll see an interesting collective phenomenon in which the bacteria need not talk to each other and agree on anything, but they will produce a flow which is beneficial to all of them. Now, how do we look at drops from the side? Here's a nice little experimental setup which we built. It's basically a fluorescence microscope sort of turned on its side and expanded. So we look at captive drops held between two microscope slides by either dark field illumination with a ring light going to a camera, or essentially laser-based epifluorescence, where a laser comes through, bounces off a dichroic, illuminates fluorescent microspheres, which can act as tracer particles, and then we look at the redshifted fluorescence in order to track the spheres as well as the bugs. So here's a little view of one of these captive drops, sped up about a factor of 100, showing you, after we've just placed a drop of suspension in between, that the bacteria swim up to the surface trying to find that greater oxygen concentration. But notice the sharp boundary, below which there's no motion. So these are the guys who are subject to such a low oxygen concentration that they're not chemotactically active. And so they seem to be left behind. Poor souls. They're just going to suffocate here. But as the instability develops, you see two things. You see this accumulation layer unstable to these plumes, that the Rayleigh-Taylor instability that I mentioned. But there's also a gradual sliding of these this thin layer toward the corner of the drop. Remember, there's air all out here. And this produces a large-scale flow that actually stirs up the entire medium. And the scale of this is millimeters. And the velocity scale is much higher than the individual swimming speed of the bacteria. So the Peclet number, that relative measure of advection to diffusion, is no longer 10 to the minus 1. It's more like 10 to the plus 2. And so the whole issue of nutrient transport, oxygen transport in this system is fundamentally different than what it would be from a single individual bacterium alone in the world.
Sorry, what is the velocity in absolute number in that?
It could be 100 microns a second. And the length scales are so much larger, you get three more orders of magnitude in the Peclet number. In fact, here's an interesting, at least for a fluid dynamicist, an interesting kind of collective behavior that occurs in the corner of this drop. So by using these microspheres that we can put in the system, we can actually trace the streamlines as this circulating flow develops. And if you average over several minutes of this, you discover that there's a persistent circulating vortex in the nose of this drop. And that's a little bit puzzling on several accounts. First of all, in the world of low Reynolds number, where there's no inertia, you know that if you stir something up and stop stirring, it will simply dissipate the vorticity instantaneously, unlike in a swimming pool on the scale that we're used to. But this is still a system where the Reynolds number is extremely small. And so how is it that we get persistent vorticity in the system? And the answer is there's energy being injected at the smallest scale by the metabolic activity of the bugs. They are injecting energy through their chemotaxis and converting it to potential energy by gathering up here, and that's getting reconverted back to the fluid flow. And this funny vortex, which is puzzling because the Reynolds number is so small, is maintained by this constant ejection of energy and dissipation at the smallest scales. Now, actually, this is an example of something which Keith Moffitt many years ago talked about as a possibility, that in these kinds of wedge geometries with suitable far-field forcing, even at zero Reynolds number, one could have this persistent vorticity. But I want to emphasize that the really interesting thing here is that this collective behavior, which required no communication between the cells, is actually responsible for a very large Peclet number that greatly enhances the oxygen transport in the system. And one can do simulations of that model and show that similar things occur. appear. I'm going to skip over this for a second. And let's now look at the accumulated corner of the drop where the bacteria have gathered right near that contact line. Here's a real-time movie showing you this zooming bionematic, this concentrated state of bacteria whose the volume fraction is something like 30% or so. And what you see in this movie, whoops, shouldn't touch that by accident. What you see in this movie is on the scale of 300 microns, which is enormous compared to individual bacteria, the development of a persistent and recurring vortices and jets of cooperative swimming, which have a scale which is quite large. In fact, I'll show you quantitatively that that can be hundreds of microns. And this turbulence, if you will, is, again, a zero Reynolds number phenomenon in this system, but it reminds you of what you often see at high Reynolds numbers.
Can you explain again what the light and dark is?
Yeah, okay. So we're looking down at a sessile drop of fluid. So here's the petri dish, here's the contact line coming down like this. And you're looking, the individual specks that you see are basically the individual bacteria. As they rotate and move, they change their effective gray level as you see it. You can't necessarily say that sometimes white is a bacterium, sometimes it's the absence of one. But this is basically just a bright field illumination. Now, if we turn off this bright field illumination and look at suspended microspheres in the system as tracers for the flow, what you see is a very chaotic and complicated flow field. Now, if you think about if there were chemical signaling between these organisms, for instance, quorum sensing chemicals or anything like that, what is the effective transport of those small molecules in the presence of this kind of flow? Just to give you an idea of what's going on, these microspheres, which are 1 micron or so, would have a typical thermal diffusion constant of something like 10 to the minus 9 centimeters squared per second. If all that was acting on them were the collisions with the water molecule. But you can just see with your eye on this scale and these time scales that the effective diffusivity is something like 4 or 5 orders of magnitude higher. So the transport of chemicals in this concentrated environment is tremendously enhanced over what it would be by pure diffusion. And it's that effective transport which we'd like to try to understand. Because in many of the interesting situations, such as in biofilms, et cetera, one is getting to very, very high concentrations. And what is the significance of this stirring for that? Now, there are experiments dating back to basically Wu and Liebscherberg several years ago on analogous behavior in thin soap films that show that these passive tracers actually are super diffusive. Their mean square displacement grows faster than linearly with time. And that's because they're getting trapped in these vortices, circulating around for a while, hopping to another one, basically getting carried much faster than they would under normal
circumstances. But they're also excluded for a much larger volume than if they were more diluted.
The bacteria or the tracers?
Either one. If you put them concentrated, then there's less volume.
This is true.
For your linear,
Well, what I'm referring to here is that may be true, but it's still effectively the case that it's faster than diffusion because of
in a linear state, yeah.
Yeah. And there are suggestions, very interesting suggestions, about basically using bacteria as stir bars for microfluidic applications because of this ability to stir things so fast. So, what is the nature of the flow field created by these organisms? Using a technique called particle imaging velocimetry, by which a movie of kind I just showed you is analyzed frame by frame to find correlations between the vector field of motion from one frame to the other, one can arrive at these kinds of swimming velocity fields at a moment in time. And if you look at this, you'll see that it's structured. This is not a random vector field. This is a highly structured pattern of swimming, which is characterized, if I give you some pointers, by, for instance, a meandering jet of high-speed swimming surrounded by circulating regions which have a very interesting handedness to them. Above this meandering jet of high-speed swimming, all of the vortices are circulating clockwise, and below they're circulating counterclockwise. So this
looks like a von Karman sheet.
Yes, thank you. Right, so it looks like a von Karman screen, which is of course something that you experience in your canoe when you put your hand through the water or an airfoil. Like that. That's a high Reynolds number phenomenon driven by inertia, but this has no inertia. At best, the Reynolds number here is 10 to the minus 2. So again, it's the input of energy at the smallest scale which is cascading upward to produce these collective structures.
So you have some kind of reverse cascade? And
yes, it's like two-dimensional turbulence in that sense. Now,
so is it possible to figure out how much energy each bacterium is actually injecting so as to make this possible?
Well, in fact, if you just go back to the original estimates so long ago by Taylor and others about swimming with a waving tail or a circulating helix, it's still only a few percent of the metabolic output of the whole organism, so it's relatively small. But it produces a collective behavior on a very large scale, such that, again, the Peclet number, this ratio of advection to diffusion, is no longer small. And it is the stirring, it is the advection, which dominates the transport in the system. Now, actually, this is quite similar to something that is seen in the field of sedimentation. Sedimentation, literally, the study of small particles sedimenting through a fluid under the action of gravity. If you take a beaker of microspheres and you simply watch those microspheres settle at any reasonable volume fraction, you will discover that if you sit yourself in the moving frame in which, on average, they are settling, that there are fluctuations around that mean which take the form of high-speed jets of particles running away from the rest with reflection-symmetric swirls on either side. And the physics of that is the hydrodynamic interactions between the settling spheres. And that is, two nearby settling spheres settle faster than those in isolation. And so if there's a fluctuation that brings a bunch of them near, they run away from the rest, and by incompressibility, they produce these swirls on either side. So a similar kind of thing here happens. Two nearby swimming bacteria swim faster than those in isolation. So if there's a local fluctuation in the order and the density, that group will run away from the rest and produce these swirls. So it appears, and I'll show you some simulation evidence by my Graham group soon, that it is purely the hydrodynamic interactions between the particles that are responsible for this collective behavior. Now, if you want, you can characterize the system as basically fluctuating vorticity. So you take the vector field that I showed you, you calculate the curl of it, color-coded for blue, positive, red, negative, what you see is this transient recurring patches of vorticity around the system that are responsible for what you see collectively. Now, in fact, we've been working hard to try to get better statistics in these systems, and it's now possible to make a kind of quasi-two-dimensional version of this problem, looking at the bottom of a pendant drop, in which you can start to get very good statistics based on these kinds of passive tracer studies. And we're trying to understand things like what is the nature of the correlation in time and in space. So for instance, given this vector field, which is basically like one would have in statistical mechanics, you can calculate two kinds of correlation functions. What is the correlation of the velocity with itself as a function of distance, and what is the correlation of the velocity with itself as a function of time? And if you look at it as a function of distance, what you see is that at any given frame of the movie, there are these persistent oscillations representing the fact that there are vortices, because if I look on the opposite side of a vortex, the velocity is going the other way. But even if you average over hundreds of frames of this, you see this persistent negative dip, which suggests indeed the importance of these vortices as the natural coherent structures in the system. But the fundamental question is, what determines the length scale, which is many, many tens of times that of an individual bug? What is this cascade of energy doing? Why does it get arrested at that scale? If you look at the temporal correlation in the system, it falls off on a time scale of about a second or two. Where does that time scale come from? And it's very suggestive that it's actually comparable to the run and tumble time, the time scale for tumbles to occur. It's also comparable to the time to use up the oxygen in one of those eddies. So these are some of the really interesting sort of statistical physics questions in this system. But really, I think the core of the problem from that statistical physics point of view is what is the continuum description of the system? How do we understand the formation of these coherent structures when we have self-propelled particles, and what are the implications for the transport of biological messengers? So the conventional picture of chemotaxis, going back to the classic work of Keller and Siegel many years ago, is like this. I have some concentration or some set of concentrations of chemicals. They diffuse around. They're consumed or produced by the individual bugs. And then I have the number density, which diffuses and has this chemotaxis term. And that's fine at the level of dilute populations where there's no fluid flow created by the mutual chemotactic behavior. But in the presence of that things are totally different. And in fact, the term that's been left out, the advective contributions, I've now shown you can be 100 times larger than the diffusion ones, which are conventionally considered. So the question really is, what is the nature of that fluid flow? And this is a subject that has been studied a lot in the applied math community and the statistical physics community. And it goes back to interesting models with the name of flocking, studied about a decade ago. So people like John Toner and Yuhai Tu asked themselves the question, how would I construct a continuum description of a bunch of objects, be they wildebeest on the Serengeti, as they said, or swimming fish or flying birds, that recognizes the fact that they have nearest neighbor interactions, at least, which tend to make them parallel as they move. So their argument was that there ought to be a description something like the Navier-Stokes equations, in which there's a velocity field and a density field, and the velocity is vectored around. It has something analogous to a pressure and diffusion, but it also has terms that recognize this nearest neighbor tendency toward parallelism. And there, by symmetry and other arguments, they suggested something like this. There are terms linear in the velocity and cubic. And so if you just throw away all these terms, you discover that the system can spontaneously pick out a direction in space in which everybody moves parallel. And so there would be a phase transition to a state of uniform swimming order. Now this is very interesting and provocative. It's an argument based on symmetries, and it predicts the existence of a phase transition. Unfortunately, it's not correct, in the sense that I've just shown you that we do not have long-range swimming order in the system. What we have is a system that's unstable to the creation of these persistent vortices. So it's a little bit like some of the spin models in statistical physics years ago, which don't have true long-range order, but have some kind of different kind of order. And so now there's a whole huge literature developing on what are the proper continuum descriptions of these kinds of systems. There are models due to Ramaswamy and collaborators that basically come from the liquid crystal world, or the world of gels, in which one tries to augment this with representations of the hydrodynamic interactions. In the applied math community, Andrea Bertozzi and collaborators here at UCLA have been looking at swarming models, where you can develop coherent vortical structures just by these local rules. And there are models involving thin-film fluid mechanics, which are suggestive of the fact that one can produce these persistent vortical structures through these hydrodynamic interactions. But these are phenomenology. And a very interesting piece of work by Mike Graham and collaborators that came out last fall made a very sharp affirmative answer to the question, is it possible for the hydrodynamic interactions alone to produce these kinds of structures? So they looked at numerical computations of large numbers of swimmers, which are mathematical structures that are self-propelled, basically the elementary such descriptions in fluid mechanics, in a box. And they discovered that as one went to higher volume fraction, the typical velocities in the system would suddenly make a transition to much higher values, and there would appear in the velocity fields exactly the kinds of coherent vortical structures that we had seen in the experiments. And the only input in the system were the hydrodynamic interactions between the bugs. There was no run and tumble statistics, there was no chemotaxis, nothing. It's just the hydrodynamic interactions.
And the different volume fractions.
And the different volume fractions, right. And so there's actually a transition point as a function of volume fraction, when suddenly the transport is greatly enhanced and you form these coherent structures. So I leave this as a challenge to the community based on Graham's results to really answer this question, what is the proper continual limit of this system and how do we understand transport and dynamics in this concentrated regime?
Right.
Yes.
In their model, they give them
Well, it's a bunch of they're not Stokeslets but dipoles. Okay, so it's basically just a point particle that's self-repelled, so it has a characteristic velocity. If it was alone in the world, it would just move in a straight line forever. And now you put a bunch of these together, and they respond to the mutual fluid flows created by each other with the long-range kernel that comes from Stokeslets and dipoles. So yesterday we heard in Dr. Kaiser's talk a very interesting issue about reversing vectoring. And I thought I would just mention a little bit of an interesting kind of reversal that we discovered that bears on the question of what are the symmetries in this system between going forward and going back. when you have propulsion by multiple flagella on a bacterium. Just at the moment we were publishing this, it came out a very nice cover in the New Yorker. I think it was around the time of the Tour de France. And so here's a bunch of bicyclists going one way, and here's this poor guy heading the other way. And the question is, what happened? So really, we were asked ourselves, what is the response of an individual bacterium to something in its path, an obstacle? That could be a wall. It could be another cell, or it could be a group of cells. And this gets to the question of, what is the mechanism of recruitment of organisms to these phalanxes, these ordered collective groups? And we've termed this swimming in the same direction quorum polarity. And so the question is, what are the mechanisms of quorum polarity? And I'll show you a curious little observation, at least for Bacillus subtilis, that in fact forward and backward are essentially dynamically equivalent, despite the fact that the flagella have to be flipped from one side to the other. And this relates to some work, detailed work done by Turner and Berg some years ago on E. coli, and also on monoflagellated organisms by Magirama. So the experimental setup that we developed for this is basically a small gap produced by the placement of a large glass sphere on a microscope slide. And the bacteria can swim into this little wedge-like region and eventually find themselves unable to go further. The question is, what do they do? So we just look at this from below and watch the trajectories of individual bugs. So here is what we'll call a bacterial reversal, caught red-handed. So here's this bacterium swimming up to the sphere, which is over here, and it just decides to reverse. And it really, I mean, the referee didn't believe us at first when we submitted this. He said, no, I mean, you haven't proven to me that it didn't just turn its body around and go out. But we've got hundreds of these in which these bacteria swim up into this corner, they wait a while, and they just back out. And the question that we've now answered is, what is the relationship of the swimming speed out here, going in and going out? The answer is, it's basically identical, suggesting that they actually have this ability to flip rather easily their swimming direction under some kind of stress. So basically we look at this on a large scale, several hundred microns, and we just watch the trajectories of the bugs coming in and out to this constriction and do statistics on the velocities. And by the time they stop, the size of the region based on the radius of the sphere is about 1.1 microns, which is just about the size you would guess that a bacterium like this would have to stop at. So basically, we have all these trajectories of velocities coming in. They, as a function of time, they hover around near the cell, near the sphere, and then they come out. And we look at the asymptotic velocities in and out, as well as the entire profile of velocities, and eventually do statistics on this and discover that the outward asymptotic velocity as a function of the inward asymptotic velocity is basically perfectly correlated. There's a wide range of velocities, but everything clusters near the center. So basically, they can, with great efficiency, flip their flagella around and simply move in the opposite direction. So it's kind of like a pneumatic liquid crystal that has symmetry plus and minus. So that's probably one of the ingredients in this whole quorum polarity issue. So now that I've given you some idea of how one can have collective behavior that generates high velocity flows from individual organisms, and surely this has a large effect on the transport of chemical messengers and other such things, let me use some of that insight to ask a question about evolutionary biology, where again we're going to see that the Peclet number rears its head, but in a much more controlled situation, which with much more controlled flows that we might be able to study quantitatively.
Good question about the reversal. Know anything about how it does that, how it decides when to do it?
We have tried and had difficulty in actually implementing the fluorescence labeling technique for that was used in E. coli for Bacillus subtilis here, in which case, if we were successful, we would actually be able to see what the flagella are doing. We haven't done that for Bacillus subtilis. We're trying to do the analogous experiments for E. coli, where we know we can label it as for a group.
There's a wedge, right? Do they sense the space, or they just really want to really?
Well, basically, if they're swimming within some angular cone into the center, they'll get stuck and come out. If their impact factor is too large, they'll just glance off. So it seems that it's probably something literally about the constraining steric interactions with the surface that is giving them the signal to turn around.
So maybe some sort of land scale of pendulum coming back or something.
Yeah, in fact, if you look at the trajectories, you see that by the time the gap is about 10 microns deep or so, they don't really know about it much at all. Below that, they do. So this is one ingredient in this quorum polarity, this ability to flip their direction. Another ingredient is how they respond to shear. And this is a very interesting subject about the response of a swimming organism with this kind of appendages to shear and how they're recruited into these flows.
If you put oxygen there or some food, how long would they stay? And would they turn around?
I don't know a precise answer to that, but in circumstances where you create, let's say, an oxygen bubble in a closed container, they'll just hover around there for a long time, but it's a complicated dynamic. They're not just sitting put.
So if that, yeah, all right, so if that was a gas bubble, then they would go over. So there's a signal there from the oxygen or the food or lack of it.
In this case, the petri dish you're using is gas permeable. And so they hover around the bottom with no preferred state. That's one of the reasons why they stay at the bottom. I mean, they're also denser, but they like the bottom because that's where the oxygen concentration is. Yeah.
I'm trying to get a sense of if you locate the signal there, that you wouldn't get this reversal.
Quite possible, absolutely. This is just a response to steric stress.
Why did they reverse? Why didn't they sort of go around the beam?
Sometimes they do, but this is an interesting puzzle that nature has given them the ability to simply decide that they're stuck and to just flip and go the other way.
Do they need some chemical that tells them the way back?
I don't have any direct measurement of such.
A trail like of chemical that tells them like a beacon.
They may, but I don't think so.
That's kind of cool.
Okay, so let's now switch gears and try to ask a more precisely formulated question about what this issue of stirring does for multicellular organisms. And I present to you the volvocene green algae. This is a family portrait of them. This is a lineage collection of species that starts with Chlamydomonas, which probably most of you have heard of. It's a single-cell, biflagellated, photosynthetic, eukaryotic plant, an aquatic plant, basically. It's less than 10 microns across. It has 10 or 15 micron flagella, which are not unlike the cilia that we have. They're not bacterial flagella, of course. They have active motors along them, and they swim in a classic manner that allows them to be phototactic. Now, there's a whole set of species consisting of, roughly speaking, 2 to the n of these in an organism. And the smaller of these species are rather irregular shapes, but very soon, as one gets to higher ones, they are with a body plan that's basically a spherical extracellular matrix, which shows up transparent here. It's an extension of the cell wall, basically. And these are anchored in that with their flagella pointing out. And these organisms get bigger and bigger and bigger as you go up this lineage. Now, the key thing I want to point out to you here is that as we move up in this lineage, there is a very clear dividing line between those organisms for which all of the cells participate both in vegetative behavior and reproduction, and those where there is a specialization, the so-called germ soma differentiation, the somatic cells being the surface swimmers and the germ cells being reproductive cells. So beyond Pleiaderina onto Volvox, one finds, in this case, germ cells which eventually grow up to daughter colonies, which hatch their way out, and that's the method of reproduction, whereas here all of the cells participate in reproduction. So the question I ask you is, why did nature put this dividing line here, distinguishing those without germ-soma separation with those that do? What are the physical origins, if we can identify them, of this specialization?
Is there any idea about how long since they diverged?
I don't recall that number off the top of my head, but it's a long time ago. And actually, there is evidence of that the transitions are not necessarily from this to this to this evolutionarily, but multiple directions, multiple times, polyphyletic. Okay, so of course, just to continue a little background, these were discovered by the inventor of the microscope and named by Linnaeus for the fact that as they swim, they rotate, all parts to roll. And I'll show you some examples of how they move. But right now, I just want to emphasize that this transition point is 100 or 200 microns in radius. And that's a characteristic length we'd like to try to understand. So here's a physicist's view of an elementary conundrum in this system when it comes to nutrient uptake. So suppose that you're a sphere. You know, we always talk in physics about the spherical cow. Okay. So this is the spherical cow with wiggly hairs at low Reynolds number. So suppose I'm a sphere, and I have no appendages, and I must just absorb nutrients by diffusion from my surroundings. What is the rate at which I could do that? So imagine that the concentration of said nutrients is C, and it has some value far away from the organism C infinity. The steady state diffusion profile would be an inverse distance relationship, where R is the radius of the cell. So if you just calculate the fixed law of flux from this, where you take a diffusion constant and calculate the gradient, integrate it over the sphere, the current of nutrients from diffusion would be linear in the radius, not quadratic. It's linear because, while it's true that you integrate over a sphere and you get a factor of 4 pi r squared, the gradient of the concentration evaluated on the surface goes like 1 over 2. So when I look at a series of organisms like that lineage that I just showed, we have a body plan in which all the metabolic tissue is basically on the surface. All the green photosynthetic tissue is sitting on the surface. So if I imagine looking at organisms composed of those replicating somatic cells, the nutrient needs would increase like the radius squared if that's a surface area. So the current of metabolic needs would go like R squared. So somewhere these must cross. Now it's a little difficult, looking in the literature on metabolic activity, to estimate exactly where these cross. Nobody has done the experiments exactly as you would like. But our best guess, looking at phosphate and oxygen dynamics, is that this bottleneck radius is about 50 to 200 microns, which is very interestingly close to where Pleiadrina is, which is the start of this germ soma differentiation. So it's suggestive, and I'll continue on this line, that in fact the issue of nutrient uptake has something to do with germ soma differentiation. Now, there are some important biological considerations in this problem. Very interesting piece of work by Bell and Cupano some years ago pointed out the fact that the extracellular matrix, which I just described to you as a kind of scaffolding to hold things together, can actually be a storehouse of nutrients. And it can be a kind of dynamical buffer to allow a concentration of nutrients, such as to create a flux down to those daughter colonies on the inside, that is both smoother and at a higher rate than you would have for isolated germ cells without that ECM. But the most important issue in this problem is the flagellation constraint, which is not a medieval torture device. The flagellation constraint is a very interesting biological fact, which is that the anchoring of these flagella into the cell, the so-called basal bodies that hold these flagella, are also the so-called microtubule organizing centers, MTOCs, that are responsible for chromosome separation during cell division. So the cell can't do both things at once. It can't swim with its flagella and go through cell division. It must stop. So the flagellation constraint is that when you are dividing, you can't swim. And that will.
Haven't we heard somewhere that flagella are only good for one thing and one thing only?
And what is that one thing?
Basically moving around, and
yeah.
So therefore it can't evolve. You know,
I'm here to suggest another use.
Okay, very nice.
Okay. So this is really interesting and very important, and we didn't understand this at first, but afterwards it was one of those things that we thought, wow, that really makes sense, because I will show you a couple of different experimental studies, one of which uses a deflagellation method. Basically, a pH shock can be used to make the colonies throw off their flagella, and you can start to study their metabolism in the presence and the absence of flagella to understand that significance. And the regrowth can be inhibited with certain chemicals. Now, the class of experiments first done by Chris Solari, who was a graduate student in ecology and evolutionary biology, involved not any detailed fluid dynamic measurements, but simply using this deflagellation and the inhibitor of regrowth to study whether bubbling air through the medium could be a substitute for the stirring which the flagella normally provide. And so, for instance, we looked at germ cells that are liberated from their colonies, so without the extracellular matrix, just growing by themselves, and looked at the growth rate of those germ cells. And sure enough, if you remove the cells from the mother, you discover that they grow less well, which is what Bell and Cupano suggested was proof that this ECM is playing a role in providing a nutrient storehouse. Likewise, if you deflagellate the mother and look at the growth of the germ cells, it's much less. But if you bubble air through the medium, put the stirring back that was removed by deflagellation, discover the growth rate goes right back to where it was in the beginning. So this is suggestive that stirring of the medium plays a role in metabolic activity. But to do this really correctly, we have to measure the flow. And here's, one of my favorite pictures, illustrating using a micropipette to hold one of these colonies, the incredibly interesting flow fields and long-range flow fields that are created by the flagella on the surface of this organism. And I've been talking about the Peclet number incessantly here. I'm going to provide for you some experimental demonstration of how big the Peclet number actually is for these systems, and we'll see it's so large that the whole issue of nutrient uptake is turned on its head. So the life cycle of Volvox is a 48-hour one. Basically, you can pick it up where the daughter colonies emerge from the mother. They have germ cells in them, which after a period of time divide to form the future daughter colonies through a day-night cycle, and then eventually they're reborn. And so by synchronization in a diurnal growth chamber, one can have a large population of these, which you can study reproducibly. So just for your amusement, here's in one of the Volvox species, the hatching of these daughter colonies from the mother. Here's one that's just come out, and see how beautifully it's spinning. It's spinning because the flagella are organized basically from the North Pole to the South Pole, beating like this, but there's a slight tilt to the way they force the fluid, and so as they beat, they make the thing spin. Anyway, beautiful organism.
Is it?
Is it?
The beat is synchronous?
Yes, I'll show you some movies of that in a moment, which raises some really interesting questions about the means of synchronization, whether it's hydrodynamic. In many of the Volvox species, there are no cytoplasmic connections between the somatic cells. There's no nervous system, but yet everything is synchronized, and that is a very interesting issue. So to study these things...
Are there no chemical signaling things that affect
none that I know of that are responsible for motor synchronization. And the belief, just like in metachronal waves and ciliates, is that it is purely hydrodynamic. So the method to study this in detail is this same particle imaging velocimetry I described before. So we use micropipettes to gently hold the colonies in a fluid that's been seeded with microspheres. And just so you see, although you can't resolve at this magnification of the individual flagella here, this is this little mixmaster pushing fluid past it. Now this is several hundred microns. And so the scale of the velocity field created by this thing is that big. And that already tells you the possibility of advection being dominant over diffusion.
Can you calculate the energy input just from that flow field?
We haven't done that, but we can. But again, I suspect it's a small fraction of the metabolic activity. As we go closer, you can see there's a nice stagnation point here, and the flow goes one way or the other. This is in fluorescence, so you don't see the colony, you just see the microspheres. Some of the microspheres stick to the flagella, and you can see them whipping around. And as we get closer, you can start to see how complicated this flow is. So here are some of these stuck beads going around. There's a tremendous acceleration of the flow as you move along here. And it's actually interesting that it's sort of laminar if you look on the large scale, but locally, it's almost chaotic. In fact, if you look really close, it's like a pinball machine. And this issue of what is this chaotic flow near the surface and how it affects the uptake of nutrients, I think, is a fascinating one. I don't have any good answers to how to think about that in detail. Okay, here are high-speed movies, 125 frames a second, showing you the synchronized beating of these flagella. They're so cute. It's like the Olympic synchronized swimming. And you can see how they just basically make little tracer particles get carried from one to the next. And again, there are no cytoplasmic connections between these. And they're nicely in synchrony. And the whole issue of phototaxis and all of that involves essentially the coordinated beating of these things, but it's mostly in response to the light signals, not some central pattern generator. Okay, this PIV method is very powerful. It allows you to construct the vector field of fluid motion with some detail. So for instance, if we look at the colony on axis, there are the daughter cells in the back and in the front, there are none. If you look at it on axis where the flagella are going like this, but at a slight angle, you can see the swirl that they create that's responsible for its rolling motion. So you can be quite quantitative about this. Now a large body of experiments I'm going to summarize by these two graphs. This is basically looking as a function of time, or the stage in the 48-hour life cycle. We call them hatch, when it's just born, division, when the germ cells are producing daughter colonies, when the daughter colonies are finished, and then just before hatching, at various quantities, like the beating frequency of the flagella, the length of the flagella, but more importantly, the maximum fluid velocity along the periphery of the colony, just as a measure of the typical fluid, characteristic fluid velocity in the system. and also the radius as a function of time as it grows. And you see this remarkable bump up in the fluid velocity by roughly a factor of 2 for Volux-Cartwright, just at the point of cell division. So first of all, these are very large velocities, up to 700 microns per second, which is an enormous velocity compared to, say, the swimming speed of bacteria. But just at the point where you might imagine the greatest metabolic needs of the system is where the fluid velocity makes a big bump. Now, all that's happening during this expansion of the colony is that the distance between the somatic cells is increasing. There are no more being added. It's just like a balloon inflating. So it's almost like there's a resonance. There's a magic spacing at which the fluid velocity suddenly increases. And it's quite significant. Now, given that radius and that velocity and the diffusion constant of something like oxygen, these are the Peclet numbers that one gets out of the system. So they're easily in the range of several hundred. So I call this life at high Peclet number, with apologies to Berg and Purcell, who talked about life at low Reynolds number. So roughly speaking, advection is 250 times as important as diffusion for these organisms. And that, I think, is very interesting when it comes to the question of metabolic uptake. Now, it would be nice to have a yes?
What about mixing inside the sphere?
So the conventional wisdom, which I'm not sure has really been tested, is that it's all diffusion.
Right.
And so we want to actually start injecting some microspheres and seeing what's going on, because it's not clear that it is.
But the sphere itself is relatively quite fast. So you might have some steering also due to that.
Well, given the structure of the extracellular matrix, I think it's like a sponge. I don't think you're going to get that kind of mixing.
Just on the outside.
Yeah.
Now, I'm confused, because you told us that during cell division they can't use their flagella, and therefore...
The germ-soma differentiated ones do, because they have the daughter colonies inside which are doing all the division, and the specialized somatic cells which never participate in that. So basically it appears that the bottleneck radius is right at the point where, rather than give up the nutrients, they differentiate. And I'll get to that in a second. So in order to make this quantitative, let's see if we can construct a model, a simple mathematical model for the fluid flows and nutrient uptake created by these organisms. I don't want to sit here and have to write down PDEs for 5,000 flagella on the surface of a sphere. There must be a simpler way to do this. And so our idea was basically to say, look, the net effect of these flagella doing this is to create a stress on the surface, a forcing of the fluid, a force per unit area averaged over time, that takes the form of a shear stress, F. So let's just basically cover the surface with a vector field of forcing that looks like that, and then find the fluid velocity from that. So that's an exercise in Legendre polynomials and things like that. You can calculate those velocity fields in the radial and azimuthal direction. And the key thing, the key result of this, is that the characteristic fluid velocity in the system, which would be the swimming speed, or the maximum velocity here, is proportional to the forcing, proportional to the radius, and inversely with the viscosity. So if you had a species series in which F were constant, which is roughly speaking true, the bigger organisms would swim faster. And that's true. Volux-Cartwright swims many times that of Chlamydomonas or Eudorina, and as you go to even higher ones like Volux-Gigas, it swims even faster. So that's sensible, and you can actually measure this F by the deflagellation technique. You can actually watch how fast they swim against gravity, deflagellate and watch how fast they sink, and know the force they were acting against. Kind of like the Millikan oil drop experiment. I like that. So here's the result that comes out.
Much easier than
the Much easier, yeah. So look, the Peclet number is the diameter times the characteristic velocity divided by the diffusion constant. But here's the characteristic velocity. So now you see that the Peclet number goes like R squared. Meaning it goes up really fast with radius. But the Peclet number is dimensionless. And so if I isolate R squared, everything else must take the form of a radius. And so there's a new length in this problem, which is given by the diffusion constant, the forcing, etc. And it turns out to be about 10 microns, which is about the size of Chlamydomonas, and it's about the size of the flagella. Two interesting further coincidences of nature. But it's significantly less than the bottleneck radius, which is 100 or 200 microns. So basically, organisms that are smaller than R sub A have the low Peclet number regime. Organisms that are larger have the high Peclet number regime. So nature has handed us this beautiful spectrum spanning low to high. Now, from this calculation, one can get, for instance, the azimuthal's flow speed along the surface. And we check by looking at the PIV results for a number of colonies that if you actually average together a normalized velocity, it fits the theoretical curve extremely well, suggesting that this simple shear model is a reasonable picture. But the really interesting question is, how does this affect this bottleneck? So to answer this, we actually just did some direct finite element calculations solving this advection diffusion problem for an absorbing sphere, pushing fluid past it with that velocity. And here are some pictures to illustrate what's going on. So think of this as the concentration of oxygen or carbon dioxide or whatever you wish from an absorbing sphere. Red is the far field value, blue is zero. And the Peclet number advancing here can be thought of as either the organism's getting larger and larger with that advected radius fixed, and I'm just rescaling the pictures down, or it's basically swimming faster. So at Peclet of order one, there's not much distortion of this velocity field, but as the Peclet gets higher and higher,
which way is the shear going?
The flow
right
is this
left.
Way. Yeah. So as the Peclet gets higher and higher, you notice a little boundary layer that develops at the leading edge, and that's where all the action is. And that boundary layer actually has a size that scales inversely with the power of the Peclet number. It's getting narrower and narrower as you get higher and higher flow field. And this is the cause of all the interesting behavior in the system. And
can I ask kind of
yes.
a silly question? What's going to become the daughters are by the blue end.
Yeah,
originally
yeah.
Originally, I thought that it was trying to pump
right.
nutrients towards where the daughters are, but actually, it's the other. It
yeah.
doesn't work out that way.
Well, okay, it's interesting because if you look at perturbations to this flow field that have little eddies and things like that, you discover that you can homogenize this much more. So I'm not quite sure how to interpret that, but it is a very interesting one. Now look, this problem, this is a chemical engineering problem that was actually solved a long time ago, sort of. Yeah. So the question is, if I have a sphere that has got flow past it and it's either giving up or taking up some kind of scalar, like temperature or a concentration field, what is the rate at which it does that as a function of the flow field? Now, Akerbos and Taylor, not GI, but a different one, many years ago, looked at this problem for a solid sphere that's hot in a wind. And they showed that the current, the heat current coming off the sphere, was proportional to the radius, and the Peclet number to the one-third. That power comes from a boundary layer, and it's specific to the boundary conditions of a solid sphere. It was not until a few years ago that Tim Pedley and collaborators at Cambridge revisited this problem and imagined what would happen if the velocity field, instead of the stick boundary condition of a solid, had a prescribed tangential velocity. They were interested in things they called squirmers, which were models of self-propelled organisms. And they discovered that this power law changed to Peclet to the one-half. You might say, well, who cares? But it turns out to be very significant. If you look near the surface of our colonies, this forcing field is basically producing a characteristic velocity, which is not unlike the tangential velocity that they looked at. And if you just do a balance between advection and diffusion for the radial velocity, you'll discover by dimensional analysis that the scale of the boundary layer in which this concentration profile lives is Peclet to the minus one-half, like I showed you on the previous graph. But more importantly, if you calculate the current of nutrients into the organism, you know it's an integral over the surface of the fixed law gradient of the concentration. But since there's only one length scale in the problem, namely the advective radius, that's the size of the boundary layer, this gradient is nothing but the concentration of affinity divided by R, and so actually the nutrient uptake rate is proportional to the surface area, because you've scrunched down in this boundary layer all the concentration gradients, and so everything is proportional to the surface area. But that's a miracle, because the bottleneck was there, because with diffusion alone, the current was proportional to the radius, not R squared. So if we revisit this bottleneck graph I showed you before, now on a log-log scale, the diffusive uptake rate has slope 1 on this log-log scale, R to the 1. The metabolic needs have slope 2, R squared. And the full calculation shows that in the presence of this stirring, as a function of the Peclet number, basically, you start off with the diffusive behavior, but as soon as you get beyond 10 microns or so, you segue to a scaling law that's R squared. So this is suggestive that thus swimming increases the nutrient uptake rate at such a scaling law as to eliminate the bottleneck and basically allow organisms, by this argument, to grow arbitrarily large and not be limited by this diffusive behavior they had before. Hence, a second purpose for flagella. Now, if you actually look at the extra bit that you get here, the extra nutrient uptake per unit area as a function of size, there's a tremendous advantage to grow from the order of the advective radius to about 10 times its size, and then it levels off. So this is possibly, I'm speculating here, this is possibly the answer to the question, which I thought was very nicely posed by Nicole King at Berkeley, which is, what are the advantages of staying together? And apparently, at least in this system, it would be a greater rate of nutrient acquisition per cell. So, where do we go from here? Well, obviously, we'd like to test some of these scaling laws more precisely. We'd like to have a true range of organisms and understand whether the fluid velocity is scaling the way I say, what determines the rotational frequency of the volvox, as you see here. Direct measurements of the metabolic activity in the presence and absence of flagella, that would be the real smoking gun for this. And we're trying to do that now using a fluorescence method. And I think from a physics point of view, the synchronization of the flagella through this hydrodynamic coupling is an unsolved problem, but a very profound one, because there's no nervous system here, and yet it functions beautifully as this phototactic organism. Now, I've talked a lot about the flows external to the organisms, but as we know, internal to large cells, one often finds cytoplasmic streaming. And if you look at the numbers, the Peclet number internal to cells with cytoplasmic streaming is also very large, easily 100 or more, suggesting that, again, the whole rate of nutrient transport within large multicellular organisms, the classic example being large single-cell organisms like Acetabularia, which can be this big, really needs to be thought of more carefully.